Good morning and welcome to Earth Gauge Radio on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa, online at earthgauge.ca and ckcufm.com. My name is Mark Brooks, and I'm here every week on Ottawa's only radio show dedicated to bringing you news and interviews on environmental issues from here in Ottawa, across Canada, and around the world. This is the May 9th edition of Earth Gauge, and after a week off last week, we're back with a special program on the Kalamazoo River oil spill. Do you remember that one? It happened in the summer of 2010, just a couple weeks after BP finally sealed their leak in the Gulf of Mexico following the explosion of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig that killed 11 workers. Oil gushed out of the well on the bottom of the ocean for nearly 3 months as the world looked on in horror. Yet, once BP finally fixed the problem, we were treated to another oil spill, this time in the town of Marshall, Michigan, where an Enbridge pipeline burst, sending roughly 1 million gallons of tar sands crude into the Kalamazoo River. I was fortunate to be invited to participate in a journalism fellowship program last week in Kalamazoo, Michigan, in which a number of environmental journalists, including myself, had the opportunity to explore what exactly happened 2 years ago, almost three years ago, when the Enbridge pipeline burst, and to investigate the legacy of the spill. So we're going to hear a couple different perspectives today from residents who have been affected by the spill and its aftermath. First, we hear from Susan Connolly. She's a local resident who was living near the site of the spill when it occurred. Her kid's daycare was just a half mile away, so she'll tell us about some of the health effects her family and her community suffered following the spill and in the intervening 3 years. Next, we'll hear from another local resident, Jeff Insko, who started the Line 6B Citizens blog. After the rupture of this pipeline, known as Line 6B, Enbridge decided to replace a huge section of pipe through Michigan, some of which runs through the property of local residents. So Jeff will tell us why he has been less than satisfied in his dealings with Enbridge, as they exercised their legal authority to dig up his property and cut down his trees in order to install new pipe. First, though, we're going to hear an overview of this whole issue from Rachel Maddow of MSNBC, who did a feature on the Kalamazoo spill last summer, at the time when the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board issued a scathing report about Enbridge's handling of the spill and their mistakes leading up to it. Why does a pipeline rupture in Michigan matter, you ask? Well, because as you're well aware, many plans are afoot for new pipelines from the tar sands of Alberta, both through the U.S. in the form of the Keystone XL pipeline and to the west coast of B.C. with the Northern Gateway pipeline, among many other proposals. So today we're going to find out about the experiences of local residents looking back 3 years later at the Kalamazoo River spill in 2010. Are there some lessons for the rest of us to learn as we contemplate the construction of new pipelines? Stay tuned for that coming right up. Of course, we'll also have our usual update from Kathy of Ecology Ottawa on local environmental events and campaigns. That's at around 7:50 or so. So stay tuned. Plenty to get to. This is Earth Gauge Radio on ckcufm.com. We're online at earthgauge.ca, where you can download or stream the show at any time of your choosing. Facebook.com/earthgauge radio, podcasts on iTunes, and you can contact me at earthgageradio@gmail.com. All right, the time now is 7:14, and we will be right back to talk about the Kalamazoo River oil spill. Stay with us.
The day is near. The day is coming. You know what I mean. The day is coming. The way is clear. The day has come.
Okay, here we go. We're talking about the Kalamazoo River oil spill today. And just to get a little context on what actually happened in the summer of 2010, I'm going to play a piece from the Rachel Maddow Show from MSNBC, which was broadcast last July 2012, at the time when the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board issued their report on what happened in Michigan on the Kalamazoo River back in 2010 at the time of the spill. Take a listen to this.
for more than three agonizingly long months. Residents of the Gulf Coast and people all across the country watched in a state of prolonged horror as hundreds of thousands of gallons of black, sticky, toxic crude oil flowed into one of this country's most treasured bodies of water, the BP oil spill. As days turned into weeks and then weeks turned into months, we all sat essentially helpless as one of the richest corporations the planet has ever known tried and failed and tried and failed and then tried and failed again to contain, let alone stop, that leak in the Gulf of Mexico. But finally, after 87 long days, the country could at least start to breathe again. The flow of oil had been stopped. That was July 15th. That feeling of momentary relief, that feeling that we could finally exhale, that lasted all of 12 days before here we go again.
With the current sensitivity about oil, a spill in Michigan is getting a lot of attention. A leaking pipeline that sent oil into a creek that feeds the Kalamazoo River. And while booms have been deployed, an estimated 848,000 gallons of oil has already escaped. Trails of oil sheen can be seen all the way down the river, far from the bulk of the spill.
Less than 2 weeks after BP finally managed to plug their leaking well in the Gulf of Mexico, it happened again, but instead of BP this time, it was a Canadian oil company called Enbridge. And instead of watching the people of Louisiana and Mississippi and Florida begin to fear for their own livelihood, now it was the people of Michigan. The Kalamazoo River was in an instant transformed into a sea of oil, a 30-inch pipeline, a big 2.5-foot-wide pipeline that ran beneath the surrounding wetlands, ruptured out of nowhere. It sent oil rushing into the Kalamazoo River. It sent entire Michigan communities into a state of emergency.
About 877,000 gallons of oil have spilled out into the creek here near the Kalamazoo River. I spoke with an official with the state, and they say this may be the worst oil spill ever in the Midwest.
What happened along the Kalamazoo River in Michigan 2 years ago would soon become the single most expensive onshore oil spill in U.S. history. And that's because there was one key difference between what happened off the coast of Louisiana, what had happened in all other major oil spills, and what happened in Michigan 2 weeks later. What happened off the Gulf Coast was the sort of spill that we've sadly sort of grown accustomed to dealing with as a country. It was a crude oil spill. We are not very good at cleaning up crude oil, but we at least have a lot of experience trying to do that. What happened in Michigan, however, was not crude oil. It was something called tar sands oil. Tar sands oil that was being transported from Canada. And as it turns out, we have no freaking clue how to clean up tar sands oil when that kind of oil spills. Crude oil generally floats to the top of the water, where at least some of it can be skimmed off. But tar sands oil doesn't do that. Tar sands oil sinks to the bottom of whatever it's in. How do you get oil off the bottom of a riverbed? Good question. Michigan residents saw their once pristine river essentially turn into a test lab for how to even try to clean up tar sands oil spills. The best they could come up with was to literally shake the riverbed, to agitate the riverbed with big machines in order to try to make the oil temporarily rise to the top where they could get at it. Sorry, Michigan, that's all we've got. Ultimately, the people who live along the Kalamazoo River did not have to wait 1 month for the oil company to clean up their mess. They didn't have to wait 2 months or 3 months or 4 months or 5 months or 6 months. It took the oil company 2 years to clean up the mess that they made in Michigan. And today, they got to learn what happened in the first place way back in 2010 on the day that giant spill turned their lives upside down. Today, the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, released findings of their investigation into what happened in that spill. They found that the oil company responsible for that pipeline knew about cracks in that particular stretch of pipeline a full 5 years before the pipe ruptured. Quoting the NTSB, for 5 years, they did nothing to address the corrosion or cracking at the rupture site. But wait, it gets worse. The investigation also revealed that it took the oil company, this company Enbridge, it took them a good 17 hours before they even realized that one of their own pipes had burst. And in that time, they pumped more than 600,000 gallons of oil through the ruptured pipeline and right into the river. The NTSB also found that Enbridge employees did not have adequate skills to deal with pipeline leaks. They found the company didn't bother making sure that enough resources were in place to respond to a spill like this. And thanks to lax government regulations, Enbridge never had to lay out how exactly they would deal with a worst-case scenario.
This accident was a result of multiple mistakes and missteps by Enbridge. Safety is a commitment. It is a requirement. It must be a way of doing business and not just a slogan. If companies can commit to safety with the same vigor that they pursue profits, then we will see integrity management programs with real integrity.
Enbridge, for their part, responded today by saying that they met all regulatory standards at the time of the Kalamazoo River oil spill. Think about that for a second. If that's true, if that's not an endorsement for more and better and more aggressive regulation of this particular industry, it is hard to imagine what would be. Look, when used as directed, we can produce a spill like this, and it'll take 2 years to clean it up, and we'll have no idea how to do it.
All right, welcome back. This is Earth Gauge Radio, and that was Rachel Maddow from July 2012, giving us some context on what happened in the summer of 2010 at the time of the Enbridge pipeline oil spill into the Kalamazoo River in Michigan. So next we're going to hear from two of the many residents who have been impacted by the spill. I was in Michigan last week with a group of environmental journalists, and we had the chance to speak with Susan Johnson, who is a local resident who was living near the site of the oil spill when it occurred, and her kids' daycare was just a half mile away.
Yeah, I'm Susan Connolly, a resident of Marshall. Became involved when our children of, I would say irony is this morning you spent the morning at the EPA building for their presentation. Well, that used to be my children's daycare center. The daycare center closed the end of December of 2010. So that it's kind of that the daycare center is located about 3/4 of a mile where the confluence of Talmadge Creek and the Kalamazoo River intersect. So that's how we became involved the morning of the spill. Of course, we dropped off the children. Very strong odor in the air. Just took your breath away. By the time we came home to pick them up, it was apparent that the children and the staff were already having symptoms from the chemicals in the air. If you're wondering what kind of symptoms, you had a burning sensation in your, and this is us as well, not just my children, but you had a burning sensation in your eyes, in your throat. If you try to take a deep breath in, you would feel a burning sensation all the way down, almost all the way down to your stomach. Migraines, headaches, lethargy, diarrhea. Within a few days of the spill, the first night of the spill, my son was throwing up. Other children had the same symptoms, same with staff. Speaking about health complaints and documented how many people were sick, there's those that have been documented and were actually seen by physicians and maybe even had tests to check for benzene exposure. Hundreds and hundreds of residents that could smell the odors that were impacted that had health effects, but it wasn't documented. We ourselves called the CDC. We every day talking to the health department, both county and state, dealing with our own physicians, trying to go in, trying to be seen, and constantly saying, well, we can't relate it to this spill. And do you realize you're going to need to have tests that are going to cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars, and we'll never be able to relate it to this spill? So that's what got me involved in to start researching about air quality, air monitoring, every aspect about the air and health impact. And by profession, I'm a paralegal, so I start to research, and one question leads to another question to another question. And when you start to look at the big picture, that's what got me completely involved, aside from the fact that, yes, my children got sick, our dog got sick, then becoming aware of other residents and becoming friends with them and hearing what they were going through. So yes, it was. We were told with absolute certainty that the short-term health effects were acute. The county health department and the state health department. Yet, there is still a refusal to do a long-term health study.
You think people are still having,
absolutely,
suffering health impacts from,
absolutely,
2 years later?
Absolutely. There were residents that resided close to Ground Zero, but there were other residents that resided in a trailer park further down in Battle Creek, where the river literally went 3/4 of a mile around their park. And a lot of those residents had, very high exposure. They weren't evacuated. They sat there. There was monitoring that took a long period of time before any monitoring was even performed at their property. So the excuses and excuses still go on to this day, but we're just going to keep fighting for it because I think it's owed. It's owed not only to us as a community, but it's also owed to the nation because there are so many other communities that are going to be impacted by pipelines. They have a right to know, and they have a right to see what's going to happen, just like in Arkansas. They're fighting now for a health study, and I hope they get it because we're still struggling for one here.
So have you noticed any health trends among the people who were exposed, any kind of common sickness now?
I think people are experiencing, I think rashes come and go. There's a close similarity to people that are experiencing problems down in the Gulf from their exposure to this spill. The headaches, the migraines, and all of it can be excused on so many other things. And that's the concerning issue here is you can never verify, although there are some residents that I believe have had blood tests to show high levels of benzene exposure, so that can be proven, but to know whether or not cancer, we're not going to know 20, 30 years from now. So how can you say for certain? People who have been in remission and then suddenly their cancer comes back full blast, how do you know? How can you prove it? And that's what's so difficult. Again, my children were exposed. They had, with absolute certainty, they had short-term health effects. How do I know my daughter is not going to have fertility issues, or my son 20, 30 years from now when it's time for them to have a family of their own? We're not going to know. And if they do, how are you going to prove it? So that's the concerning thing, and that's a struggle that we'll be faced with.
Do you and your kids personally have any health effects? Residual health effects now?
Not now.
Okay.
We were fortunate that we live far enough away that it wasn't as bad as residents such as Deb Miller and those at Baker Estates that were engrossed in it 24/7. Okay. So that's concerning. Seizures, that's another thing. There were people that had seizures. So not myself or anyone in our daycare, but those that were in the trailer park had seizures.
I'm interested to know a little bit more about your specific story at the daycare. So it happens on Sunday, but by Monday, you're still dropping the kids off at the daycare.
Right. When we left our house 2.5 miles north, you could smell it right away just leaving our house. And you thought, oh, maybe somebody's working on a road or tearing a roof or something. Okay. So you could smell it.
So tell me a little bit about that. So what happens? You show up for daycare and...
Nobody had any idea what was going on. The directors of the daycare started calling, I believe, the county health department. And I don't believe they got an exact answer as to the spill until later in the afternoon. That's when we found out that it was an oil spill.
And you raised some concerns?
That day, absolutely. We started calling CDC. There was really no response. I can go back through all my records, but there was no response. It's an annoyance. It's an inconvenience. And yes, we realize just keep the kids inside and keep the doors closed and just keep them in and away from the chemical. Just keep them inside. And we finally got to a point after that entire week, Monday through Friday, we finally started getting fed up and called Wood TV. We called a local TV station telling them, hey, do you realize what's going on? Finally, that weekend, a guy came out and was standing at the children's playground saying, there's kids here, they're getting sick, and people are just wondering about health. That next day, we had an air monitor at the daycare center. So 8 days after the spill, we finally had our first monitoring at the daycare.
So the kids are at the daycare all week?
Yes.
For 8 days?
Yeah, 5 days, Monday through Friday.
Before the evacuation order is given?
They never evacuated. They never evacuated the daycare. They never evacuated a mandatory evacuation. So we know residents that had to evacuate and could never even return to their homes, and that's a whole other discussion.
Okay. But the kids had a full week of exposure.
Yes.
And they were playing outside on
yes.
the playground.
Yep.
What's the proximity to the river from that?
From Talmadge Creek and Kalamazoo River, about 3/4 mile.
So in an ideal world, when would you have been informed that there was a major oil spill in your neighborhood, and who would have told you?
No idea. It would be nice to know that. We had no idea that the pipeline was even in our town. I think the big thing that people have to learn now is the first people that are going to know about a pipeline and know about a spill are the residents. It's going to be the people. It's going to be those that live here. It's not going to be the pipeline company. It's not going to be your first responders. It's not going to be any of them. It's going to be us. So we have to come up with a way that we work together to have a form of communication. Whereas if it's in your backyard, that you need to contact someone. We had asked and worked with EPA asking about, can there be sirens? Can there be some type of an alert system? I hold the county and the state health department and PHMSA and our state and federal legislators at a higher responsibility than even Enbridge, because I feel they have a higher regard to take care of communities and their state than Enbridge or any other pipeline company. So they need to be held more accountable than anyone else. Because when it came to evacuation, when it came to monitoring, the primary person in charge is both your county and your state health officials.
This is Earth Gauge on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa, online at ckcufm.com. The time now is 7:31, and that was Susan Connolly, not Johnson, Susan Connolly, who is a resident in Marshall, Michigan. And she was living near the site of the Kalamazoo River oil spill in 2010 when the Enbridge pipeline ruptured. And next we're going to hear from another local resident by the name of Jeff Insko. And he started the Line 6B Citizens blog. After the rupture of this pipeline, which was known as Line 6B, Enbridge decided to replace a huge section of pipe through Michigan, some of which runs through the property of local residents. So Jeff tells us why he's been less than satisfied in his dealings with Enbridge as they exercised their legal authority, because they did have, and they do have, the legal authority to dig up his property and cut down his trees in order to install new pipe, something called eminent domain. And as we know, many plans are underway to build new oil pipelines across North America. So we would be wise to listen to the experiences of people like Jeff, who have been forced to deal with companies that want to build pipelines through their property. Here's Jeff Insko.
From my point of view, you know, we've never objected to the replacement of Line 6B. It's a 40-year-old pipe. They're pumping tar sands oil through it. The new pipe, as I'm sure they said to you today, is going to be safer and better and all of that, because obviously it's 40 years later. It goes without saying. And so I don't think that's a bad thing. So the objection we really have is not that they're replacing it, it's how they've gone about replacing it. And from my point of view, they've just run roughshod over the state of Michigan. They've dealt poorly with individual landowners. They have been dismissive of local municipalities. They have been stubborn and intractable when it came to the regulatory process here in Michigan. And so early on, back at our place, this thing was happening completely under the radar. Enbridge was having its way, and nobody was saying boo. Nobody in the press, nobody in, who's a state elected official, and landowners had no recourse, just sort of isolated and alone, and they're dealing with this company that has the power of the laws of the state of Michigan to take their land, to use their land as they please. And so we started the blog just as a way, as a kind of information awareness campaign. We started contacting politicians. We started contacting local township officials. We started trying to get landowners talking to one another. And I'll give you one example of how much this project has flown under the radar. Early on, we wrote a letter to our state senator, Debbie Stabenow, and we said, we've got serious concerns about the replacement of Line 6B. Surely you're interested in this too, given what happened in Marshall. And we got a letter back, a form letter from Stabenow's office, thanking us for contacting her about the Keystone XL project. And so we've just tried to get people in touch with one another. And we've spent a great deal of time trying to help individual landowners like Dave just by giving them with the information. Because one of the things that we learned when neighbors started talking to neighbors is that the things that right-of-way agents say, don't always square with the things other right-of-way agents are saying. And so, one of the things we've tried to do is just, give people a chance to gather information and to share information and to learn and prepare for the kind of process that Dave's going through and that I've already gone through. They put the pipe in the ground in my backyard. How much did they pay us? I'd rather not say exactly how much they paid us. But I will say that we had in our backyard a stand of trees not unlike this. It was thicker and denser, about 105 trees all told. and they were outside of the easement, and they needed from us temporary workspace just to move their equipment. And in order to gain that temporary workspace, they had to cut down all of our trees and our perennial garden. And the thing I'll say about payment, I'll tell you off the record, I guess, but the thing I'll say about, you know, that kind of compensation is the value of a 50-foot blue spruce tree to us was invaluable. I mean, that's why we bought the property. To Enbridge, you know, maybe it's timber value, if that. And so somewhere between invaluable and, you know, nothing is the compensation figure that we had to arrive at, and we weren't happy. What's that? We had 105 trees.
Yeah. They cut them all down?
They cut them all, every one of them. Yeah, they cut them all down.
Two hours east.
Where are you?
So Groveland Township, Michigan.
And without disclosing the figure, suffice to say you weren't happy with the level of
compensation. No, we weren't. No, we weren't happy with the level
of
compensation.
Was it more than what they initially offered because you had information? And
You know, we were not terribly stubborn. From the beginning, we wanted to be good faith partners with Enbridge. And we were disinclined to have a big fight. And I think that one of the things that we've learned in retrospect is that there are a lot of people along the line who were more stubborn than us, who probably were compensated better than us. But we have tried, and I still insist that, you know, I mean, it's never really been about the money for us. And we don't, on the blog, certainly I don't spend a lot of time, you know, complaining about compensation. There's a lot of other things that I'm much more concerned with than how I was personally compensated.
Like what?
Yeah. Like the way that safety concerns and siting and routing concerns on the part of local municipalities were dismissed. Enbridge was reluctant to talk to. When I first went to my township supervisor and I said, you know, there are all these people in your township that are going to be affected by this project. We should have a meeting and we should have Enbridge come and talk to us to give us information. And he said to me, oh, I'll call, but they won't come. And so it's only after a lot of complaining and squawking and bad press and noisemaking that they'll reluctantly come to the table. It's always the pattern with them. We found that we want them to tell the truth. For example, we learned pretty early on that when they have to replace the pipeline, there's a compensation price essentially for like the use of the existing easement, and that's calculated on a per acre value basis. And we learned by getting neighbors to talk to one another that they were offering, you know, one set of people X per acre value, and the people right next to them with a virtually identical piece of property a different per acre value. So right-of-way agents who were coming in and bullying people, threatening them, tossing around condemnation papers from the very beginning, creating a relationship that's not a, you know, good faith partnership but an adversarial kind of relationship. I could go on.
Enbridge was actually, you said, threatening and bullying people?
Oh, yeah. I think we have heard countless stories of people who have felt threatened and bullied by Enbridge.
Saying that this is going to happen, take it or leave it.
Oh, so. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the right-of-way agents will come into your house, and they're pulling out the... In fact, in my case, and we had our first right-of-way agent, you know, seemed to be an okay guy. But within 5 minutes of being in our house, he was showing us the condemnation papers, which in retrospect we learned at that point they didn't even have approval from the Michigan Public Service Commission giving them the right of eminent domain. It seems to me it's a blunt instrument to send people into doing their bidding.
From what you've learned and from what you've discovered from other property owners, what might you tell... what experiences might you share with people who were, for example, along Keystone XL or another pipeline, so they don't have to learn the hard way?
Yeah, great question. Talk to one another. Talk to your neighbors. Neighbors need to talk to neighbors. Contact your state elected officials and ask them to ask hard questions and not to take at face value everything that Enbridge tells them. But so neighbors talking to one another, contacting local officials, hire an attorney. There are attorneys out there who want to do right by landowners and assist them. I think those things.
What are some of the rules around easements that make it
so that they're able to do this? I mean, did they have to kind of go find any loopholes?
Basically, the easement means that they have the right to access that chunk of your property and use it to conduct their business. And in fact, in our case, it's interesting. We, you know, the easement, they paid $208 for that original easement, and they actually have the right to have two pipelines in that easement.
Has this changed how you or maybe some of your other followers of the blog, fellow residents, see your own consumer use in terms of gas and how you fit into the big picture?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, and we would go to these meetings, you know, these township meetings, and you know, if there were Enbridge people there at some point, inevitably, you know, somebody from Enbridge, Jason Mantrum or Joe Martucci, or, you know, would say, you know, we use crude oil to do all kinds of things in modern lives. It powers our cars, as if we don't all know that already. And, you know, and I would say, every time I stood up to speak, I would say, yes, I drove my car here tonight. And so, I mean, I think I've always, you know, had some concerns about fuel consumption in the modern world. I'm, you know, I try to be green in some ways. Has it changed my view on that? I suppose to some extent, mainly because of the nature of the particular product that they're transporting now. I share the concerns that so many other people do with the effects on climate change of the, you know, with the use of bitumen and all that stuff. I mean, yeah, I mean, I've always sort of been concerned, and I continue to be. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
What about your fellow victims and quotation marks?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good question. Probably not, I suppose, you know? Yeah, probably not. But the, you know, the salient point, though, for me is, and I mean, this has also been the thing that I've, you know, we've said to the Enbridge folks many times when they remind us, you know, that we depend on oil, is that, you know, like, we're not trying to stop your pipeline. We've never tried to stop the replacement of this pipeline. We just want you to behave. We want you to live up to your good neighbor rhetoric. That's the thing that we've said to them repeatedly. By the way, can I say one quick thing? I promised Beth Wallace I'd say something about the deactivated line. So The other concern that we've had all along is what's going to happen with that deactivated line. The other reason that Enbridge has sort of skirted certain regulations is that they call this maintenance and rehabilitation rather than new infrastructure. And, you know, when they say replacement, I always thought replacement means, like, you know, you take out the carburetor and you put a new one in. But they're actually leaving that old pipe in place. And we've asked repeatedly. And one of our local townships asked them repeatedly and wanted them to put in writing that they would not in the future use that line. And they refused to say that. And what they'll say to you is, we have no plans to reuse that line. But what we've learned in recent months is that, you know, TransCanada and Enbridge all over the place are reactivating old lines. They're reversing the flow of various lines. And so those are hollow assurances that they've given us.
So to put that in perspective, they, through the MPSC, got approval to do this because their line needed replacing, but they're not saying they won't ever use that.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and they were very effective. I've written about this extensively on the blog. They were very effective at the MPSC at making the questions that the MPSC could ask and address as narrow as possible. And so, for example, they were able to successfully convince the judge that the NTSB report on the spill here in Marshall was, you know, inadmissible, as if it weren't relevant to the replacement project.
So do you think Enbridge has another reason then for putting in a second line? It's not a, is it a safety thing? Because the first line has some safety concerns, or do you think they have some other motivation?
I think that it's clearly a safety concern. There's no getting around that. I mean, 2013 technology is better than 1969 technology. On the other hand, you know, PHMSA has capped the operating pressure at which the old line 6B can work, and, you know, they just can't pump the volume of tar sands oil through there at the volume they want to. And so there's clearly a financial incentive for them to replace line 6B more than anything else.
And that was Jeff Insko, a Michigan resident, talking about the new pipeline 6B that Enbridge is building through his property as well as the property of many other residents. Will his experience be echoed by the many other property owners across North America as new pipelines are constructed in the coming years? This is Earth Gauge on CKCU 93.1 FM, and today we're looking back at the lessons learned from the Enbridge oil spill into the Kalamazoo River in 2010. Time now is 7:46, and we're now going to hear from Josh Mogerman of the Natural Resources Defense Council, and he's going to give us his comments on the Kalamazoo River spill in Michigan and why this spill was particularly significant and why he believes oil from Alberta's tar sands, piping the oil from Alberta's tar sands is different from piping conventional oils. Here's Josh Mogerman.
What I think is sort of interesting, what I've been hearing today, is this whole discussion of something that is very much termed as a local issue. This is an impact on a river in Michigan or on a backyard. And what I think is the really important thing in this is that we are in the midst of a really big fundamental change in the type of fuel that we are getting in this country. There are a lot of backyards like this. There are a lot of places that are impacted, just like the Kalamazoo River. If you live in Montana, you probably saw the megaloads issue in the Lolo Pass. If you live in the Northeast, you're hearing discussions of reversed and reused pipelines, discussions of moving tar sands oil to the East Coast. If you live in Vancouver, you have heard lots and lots about the Northern Gateway pipeline. And certainly, if you're paying any attention at all in the United States, you're hearing all about the Keystone XL pipeline. In my neighborhood in Chicago, I can see the BP Whiting Refinery, which is awfully close to my house on the south side of Chicago. There was a pretty massive uproar in the entire Great Lakes over dumping of mercury and ammonia directly into the drinking water source of 40 million Americans and Canadians. These things all have to do with this shift that has been very quietly going on to tar sands oil from Canada. And so why does that matter? I know you guys heard oil is oil, and that is the pithy thing that you'll hear from industry on a pretty regular basis. And so I'm here to tell you that, first of all, oil is not oil. They're very different grades and types of oil. Tar sands or oil sands or bitumen come from an area in Alberta, Canada. It was oil. It degraded over time. It's a very low grade petroleum that, you know, usually when we think of oil, we think of, you know, Jed Clampett going out and shooting the ground, and up from the ground comes a bubbling crude. Or you see pictures of, you know, the old gushers in California. And this is something that is fundamentally different from that. This is a very large source of petroleum that is either strip mined or steamed out of the ground. It is little bits of petroleum that are mixed with sand, and in order to be used, have to be separated. This is a fuel source that comes with a lot of liabilities. And those liabilities are some of the things that we've been talking about today. Because of that sand content, because of the very high sulfur content that is normal for this oil, because of the heavy metals, and mostly because of the carbon liabilities. So one of the things we haven't talked about today at all is climate change. And climate change is at the heart of a lot of the fight that's going on over tar sands. So right now, I'm sure most of you know this, Canada is the number one provider of oil to the United States. So tar sands, when it gets stripped out of the ground or boiled out of the ground, it traditionally, when we were getting this stuff, it was going through a process called upgrading, where it went through a partial refining process. So it would be something that more closely resembled what you and I think of as oil, something that's sort of viscous, and would come down to refineries, particularly in the upper Great Lakes, but also in the northern Rockies. But over the last few years, as the price of oil has increased, it's become more economically viable to produce this stuff. It's expensive to squeeze oil out of rocks and sand. And we have been receiving more and more something that you've heard a little bit about today, diluted bitumen. Bitumen is this raw petroleum stuff. we're no longer getting bitumen that has been upgraded into SimBit. We're now getting more and more diluted bitumen, which is stuff that has gone through some processing. A lot of the sand is gone, but ultimately it is the texture of, depending on who you talk to, peanut butter or honey. It's very, very thick. It cannot flow through a pipeline on its own. It has to be mixed with diluents. You've heard about diluents. It's liquefied natural gas, a bunch of other things. It's stuff that is mixed with this so that it can actually flow through a pipeline. Tar sands pipelines, or excuse me, diluted bitumen pipelines, operate in a fundamentally different way. First of all, they require significantly more pressure to move this really heavy, sludgy stuff through the pipe. They also operate at a higher temperature. You may have heard otherwise. Those are issues as it relates to corrosion, which gets us to the Kalamazoo River.
Friend, they took around and cleaned the town until the very end. The Kalamazoo River oil spill, giving me the black and blues. Don't try to walk away from this with all that oil on your shoes. There's oil in the river, there's oil in our food. The ducks are black and greasy, it's really kind of crude. The Kalamazoo River oil spill, giving me the black and blues. Gonna walk away from this with all that oil on your shoes. Down and raise the price of gas. The Kalamazoo River oil spill, giving me the black and blues. Don't turn and walk away from this with all that oil on your shoes. Well, don't turn and walk away with all that oil on your shoes.
All right, and don't you walk away with all that oil on your shoes. That was a resident of the Kalamazoo, Michigan area, the region, and his name was Chip Crooks, and he was singing about his own tune about the oil spill that happened there in 2010. Okay, this is Earth Gauge on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa, and we are going to continue with our usual segment now with Kathy from Ecology Ottawa. She is here every Thursday to discuss major environmental issues that affect the city and its surroundings and to inform us about the different ways we can get involved. And of course, Ecology Ottawa is the volunteer-driven nonprofit organization working to make Ottawa the green capital of Canada. So hi, Kathy.
Hi, Mark.
So what's on for this week?
Well, maybe it's the warm weather shaking us all out of hibernation, but there are a lot of great events and activities happening in the nation's capital this week, so I thought I would use this time so that listeners know about everything they can get up to.
Excellent. Yeah. Man, it is sure heating up there, out there. So what do you have for us?
First up, as many as you know, the Canadian Tulip Festival, the largest tulip festival in the world, is in full swing. The festival's mandate is to preserve local heritage and celebrate the tulip as a symbol of international friendship by engaging local organizers, volunteers, artists, performers, tourists, and festival goers in what has become an annual ritual of spring and one of Canada's best-loved and well-known of cultural events. More information, because I don't have time to list all the events here, please visit tulipfestival.ca. This evening, there will be another meeting of Green Drinks Ottawa at the Fox and Feather on Elgin. Green Drinks is an open invitation to anyone interested, working, studying all things environmental. Come for interesting and inspiring conversation. Crowds start to arrive around 5:30 p.m., and the fun goes until whenever you want. Capito Velo Fest and the Canadian Tulip Festival are pumped to announce the city's Slow Bike Challenge in the Tulip Garden at Ottawa City Hall Festival Plaza on Friday, May 10th from 12:30 to 1. The Slow Bike Challenge is in celebration of the 2013 Tulip Cycle Ride, Capito Velo Fest, and Bike to Work Month. In a slow challenge, participants ride their bikes as slowly as they can over a short distance without putting a foot down. The winner is the last one to cross the finish line. In a series of rides, local, provincial, and federal politicians will compete to see who is best at slowly turning the wheels of government. Local celebrities and media reps will put forth their best efforts into peddling the news, and local workers will grind out 3-meter distance in their finest bike-to-work attire. The Whole Earth Expo will be happening this weekend at the Fieldhouse at Carleton University from 11 to 4. The Whole Earth Expo is a place to discover enlightened, healthy, and harmonious living in Ottawa. During this energizing and powerful two-day event, explore professional workshops conducted by expert speakers and browse hundreds of leading-edge products and services offered by our exhibiting companies. The Whole Earth Expo celebrates personal and social growth, bringing together individuals, experts, communities, and businesses around a holistic approach to life. The Gloucester Horticultural Society is hosting a spring flower show from 11 to 4 on Saturday at Plasterlanes. Join Gloucester Horticultural Society members inside at the north side entrance to view fresh-cut spring flowers and foliage plants from their gardens, as well as houseplants and decorative fresh flower arrangements. The flowers on display will be judged by Ontario Horticultural Association accredited judges. Saturday also happens to be World Fair Trade Day, so come support Fair Trade Ottawa Equitad. Take a sip for Fair Trade's fundraiser from 7 to 11 at the Cube Gallery on Wellington. This will be the Fair Trade event of the season, bringing together Fair Trade chocolate and wine and local foods, cheese and beer, to showcase the best of Ottawa and beyond. The evening will include friends, special guests, city councillors, and representatives from various organizations throughout Ottawa. Inspiring guest speakers will include Paul Dewar, MP for Ottawa Centre, Jennifer Williams from Coco Camino. There will also be fantastic musical entertainment, a silent auction, and more. Tickets are $30, which includes a specialty Fair Trade cocktail, which you can purchase online at fairtradeottawa.ca. Nature Canada is hosting the National Capital Region's first ever Bird Fair on Sunday, May 12th at Andrew Hayden Park. The Bird Fair will be a public celebration of International Migratory Bird Day in the National Capital Region's Lac des Chênes Important Bird Area, found right along the Ottawa River. IBA is one of 600 sites across Canada recognized internationally for their significance to bird populations. The Bird Fair offers many activities for the entire family, so come check it out. More information at lacdeschenes.ca/fair. On Monday night, the Federation of Community Associations and Ottawa Forests are getting together to host an expert panel discussion on the emerald ash borer beetle in Ottawa. Similar to the FCAEAB event last fall, the panel will feature John Meeting from Bioforest, Sean Barker from treefood.ca, and Bruce Gill from the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. Dr. Curtis Lebois from GEO will be joining the panel to comment on the health benefits of trees and what this epidemic will mean for the future health of Ottawa residents. Attendees will have a chance to speak one-on-one tree experts during the first hour before the panel discussion begins. Perfect time for residents to book an appointment to have their trees treated. So please help us spread the word by sharing this invitation with anyone you think you may be interested. The Wild Garden will be holding an edible and medicinal plant walk on Wednesday, May 15th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Windsor Park. On these walks, you will learn how to identify safe, common, bioregional plants and their edible, medicinal, and other traditional uses, proper harvesting, processing, and storage practice methods of preparation, and wildcrafting and foraging ethics. The walks will proceed light rain or shine, so please come dressed for the weather. Sample wild snacks and beverages will be provided. Single walk is $20, and you receive discount when you register for 3 or more. But kids under the age of 10 are free. No need to register. And next Thursday, May 16th, the College of Ottawa will be holding outreach team training from 7 to 9 at the Hindenburg Community Center. Information booths and door-to-door petitioning are important tools for College of Ottawa to reach out to communities across the city and find our friends. These are methods we use to speak face-to-face with people, spread our campaigns, and find out what environmental issues are important to people in their neighborhoods. Become part of the team of volunteers that staffs our booths and petitions door-to-door. You can volunteer, work close to home with events in your neighborhood, and or be active with our flying squad that joins College of Ottawa teams in their neighborhoods. The short training will give you an overview of College of Ottawa's campaigns and campaign materials. And how much time do I have?
I think we're just about out of time, unfortunately, so we'll have to leave it there for this week, Kathy. I know there's a lot on the agenda coming up. But thanks again, as always. I know you didn't get to mention the great Glebe Green Garage Sale, which is one of Ecology Ottawa's flagship events, and that's happening on May 25th. So heads up for that a couple weeks in advance.
Yep, that's right. And definitely check out our website, ecologyauto.ca, for more information on this and all the other events.
Absolutely. Thanks again for this, Kathy.
Okay, thanks.
Talk to you next time. Bye-bye. All right, and that just about does it. We are out of time here for another week here on Earth Gauge Radio. In fact, we're over time. It's 8:01, so stay tuned for the Thursday special blend coming right up. I think we have Matthew sitting in for David Yazbek today. But this has been Earth Gauge on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa, Ottawa's only radio program dedicated exclusively to environmental news and commentary from here in Ottawa and around the world. Remember, you can hear all the interviews from today's special show on the Kalamazoo River oil spill. You can hear them all again, as well as the entire program, by going to the website earthgauge.ca. And thanks to my guests today, Susan Connolly, Jeff Insko, and Josh Mogerman, as well as the Institute for Journalism and Natural Resources, who gave me the opportunity to go to Kalamazoo, Michigan last week with a group of other journalists to learn about the legacy of the Enbridge spill. Let's hope we've learned our lessons and don't repeat the mistakes of Kalamazoo as we debate the merits of constructing new pipelines across North America. EarthGauge.ca is the website. Contact me at earthgageradio@gmail.com. BBC News is coming right up. Then stay tuned for the Thursday special blend here on CKCU. We'll talk to you next time.